listening to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. This is Shane Vanderhart. Thank you for listening. I'm sorry I missed last week, but I'm incredibly happy to be back. We have a lot to discuss today. First, President Trump's press conference with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Secondly, the American Psychological Association no longer considers all pedophiles to have a mental disorder. Third, State Senator Nate Bolton out of Des Moines says he's not quitting the Iowa Senate after accusations of sexual misconduct forced him from the gubernatorial race. Then I had a chat with Jeremy Davis, who is a Republican running for the Iowa State Treasurer, against Michael Fitzgerald, who was first elected to that office in 1982. I was 10 years old. Before we get to any of that, first a word from Brian Myers, a senior contributor with Caffeinated Thoughts about Travis Riswold of Modern Woodmen of America.
Hi, this is Brian Myers. When I needed a better life insurance plan, I found it with Travis Riswold of Modern Woodmen of America. When I first met Travis, he wasn't like some other life insurance agents that can be pushy and try to get you to buy something. Travis just made himself available to me. That was it. He told me to let him know if and when I needed anything, and he stayed in touch. When the day came and I did need to make some changes with my life insurance, Travis met with me and walked me through several options so I could make an informed decision. Ultimately, it was the best decision for my situation. So if you need a life insurance plan that makes sense for you, call my friend Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen. His number is 515-883-0029. That's Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen. He can help you find the life insurance you need. Call him at 515-883-0029.
By all accounts, President Trump did not have a good press conference with Russian President Vladimir Putin, whom he met with for their summit in Helsinki, Finland on Monday. The Guardian put together this montage from the press conference that lasted 45 minutes. I have a video of the full press conference up at Caffeinated Thoughts, so I encourage you to go check that out. But here's just a few moments from the press conference that I wanted to highlight.
Would you now, with the whole world watching, tell President Putin, would you denounce what happened in 2016, and would you warn him to never do it again?
All I can do is ask the question. My people came to me, Dan Coats came to me, and some others. They said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be. I will tell you that President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today. And what he did is an incredible offer. He offered to have the people working on the case come and work with their investigators with respect to the 12 people. I think that's an incredible offer. The probe is a disaster for our country. I think it's kept us apart. It's kept us separated. There was no collusion at all. Everybody knows it.
As to who is to be believed and who is not to be believed, you can trust no one if you take this. Where did you get this idea that President Trump trusts me or I trust him? He defends the interests of the United States of America, and I do defend the interests of the Russian Federation. We should be guided by facts. Could you name a single fact that would definitively prove the collusion? This is utter nonsense.
What happened to the server? What happened to the servers of the Pakistani gentleman that worked on the DNC? Where are those servers? They're missing. Where are they? What happened to Hillary Clinton's emails? 33,000 emails, gone, just gone. I think in Russia they wouldn't be gone so easily. I think it's a disgrace.
That was absolutely incredible. He mentioned Dan Coats and other people. You know, these aren't, I know a lot of people like to, Trump supporters like to point out that, you know, the deep state. Dan Coats, the director of national intelligence, is President Trump's own appointee. These are his people that are telling them that Russia tried to interfere with our election. But he's going to trust Putin's denial. Putin, who was a member of the KGB when the Soviet Union was in power, so he was a professional spook. He can lie for a living. He can manipulate. He does manipulate. And President Trump seems to believe him over other people. This press conference is troubling to me, and I'm not alone. Ben Shapiro wrote at the National Review that he is happy there's a disconnect between what President Trump's administration does and what President Trump actually says. I agree. Shapiro writes, quote, "It was downhill from there. Trump proceeded to state that he held, quote, both countries responsible, unquote, for the deterioration of the relationship, then supported Putin's argument that Russia hadn't interfered in the American election in any way," then again quoting President Trump, "I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be. I have confidence in both parties," unquote. Shapiro continues, "Both parties, one being a murderous dictator and the other the intelligence community that works for him. All of which is disgusting, of course," unquote. Rich Lowry, also at National Review, pointed out the difference between the two countries that President Trump says was responsible. They holds responsible for strained relations. Quote, "Ah, yes, both countries. One is given to invading its neighbors, rigging elections, killing dissidents, including on foreign soil, and violating international agreements and norms in hopes of reestablishing something like the old Russian Empire. The other has a strange but apparently unbreakable habit of electing new presidents who naively believe they can reset relations with Russia based on their personality and goodwill." I mean, George W. Bush said, "I looked into Vladimir Putin's eyes and I saw into him." And then, of course, President Obama, his relationship with Putin was not great as well. Democrats are crying treason, but Shapiro pointed out he has a different explanation. Quote, "That doesn't mean, as Democrats have suggested, that Trump is in bed with the Russians. Far more likely, it means that Trump's ego is one giant gaping wound, constantly draining rage over the suggestion that his 2016 election victory was somehow ill-won. To the refusal of the former FBI director, James Comey to publicly clear him on the collusion investigation, Trump responded by firing Comey. Now he's responded to the Mueller investigation's indictment of 12 Russian government hackers by proclaiming that Putin might be innocent after all. This isn't about some nefarious plot. It's about Trump's ridiculous ego problem," unquote. I agree, which he notes is not a defense. And then he closes with this, Shapiro does, quote, "The panic induced by his verbiage should be tempered with the knowledge that he says a lot of stuff and that members of his own administration ignore most of when it comes time to implement policy. They know it, Putin knows it, and the press knows it. Only Trump seems blissfully unaware of the disconnect between the nonsense he spews and the policy his administration promulgates. In this case, we're better off for that disconnect." Totally agreed, unquote. Lowry, in his piece, said that there was a lesson for President Trump to learn from Vladimir Putin. Quote, "Trump has a strange ability to abstract himself from his own administration that he often comments on as if he's a pundit with no responsibility for it. In Helsinki, he talked about the United States in the same way as an entity he stands apart from and critiques accordingly. The result was dismaying and stood in stark contrast to his Russian counterpart. Putin knew exactly what he was doing, was always in control, and never said anything to undercut his own country," unquote. President Trump should have done the same. He should have undercut his own country. Whether President Trump realized it or not, he adopted the left's Cold War tactic of blaming America. It was embarrassing. It made the United States look weak. And this is really no better. In fact, I think it's worse than President Obama's comment that he'll reset relations with Russia after he was reelected. President Trump rhetorically reset our relationship with Russia. Let's hope that that doesn't translate into policy. The Huffington Post reports that the American Psychiatric Association, the APA, in their new DSM, says not all pedophiles have a mental disorder. Really? Hunter Stewart, writing for HuffPo, writes, quote, "In a move towards destigmatizing pedophilia, the American Psychiatric Association in its updated Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or the DSM, distinguishes between pedophiles who desire sex with children and those who act on those desires. The former group, those who want to have sex with children, but whose desires are not distressing or harmful to themselves or others, is no longer classified as having a psychiatric condition in the updated DSM, unquote. Ray Blanchard, who co-wrote the chapter on sexual disorders in the new DSM, told HuffPo, quote, "The difference is you're not automatically saying that as soon as someone has marked unusual erotic interest that they have a mental disorder," unquote. The article continues, quote, "The change in the DSM, a kind of Bible among medical professionals, lawmakers, and drug and insurance companies, doesn't just apply to pedophilia, but to several other deviant sexual desires listed in the manuals. It represents a, quote, subtle shift but crucial difference that makes it possible for an individual to engage in consensual, atypical sexual behavior without inappropriately being labeled with a mental disorder," explains the APA in its DSM-5 paraphilic disorders fact sheet, unquote. This is just a step to normalize pedophilia. The APA did this with homosexuality. I fully expect that they're going to do the same, if they haven't already done the same, with transgenderism. While having a desire is not criminal, certainly, desires lead to actions, and this step by the APA, I think, will result in people not seeking help before they actually act out on those desires. Whether or not the DSM-5 considers it a mental disorder, pedophilia that is, this behavior toward children, these desires toward children, it's evil. The Bible considers all sex outside of marriage between one man and one woman to be sinful. And to desire that and to fantasize about that and to, just even let that stew in your mind, that's sinful as well. The Bible also notes that sin starts with temptation or desire, and it needs to be stamped out at that point. James chapter 1, verses 14 through 15 says, quote, "But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desires. Then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death," unquote. The battle starts in our minds, as we see in Romans 12, 1 through 2. The Apostle Paul wrote, quote, "I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what the will of God is, what is good and acceptable and perfect," unquote. We need to have a relationship with Christ first, and we need to have the Holy Spirit transforming our minds so we're thinking clearly about these things. But any action starts first of all with a thought. And I'm sorry, by legitimizing pedophilia, even if the person doesn't act out on it as okay and not a disorder, you know, I think is inappropriate at best, foolish at worst, or disastrous at worst. And I'm afraid that we're going to end up seeing children, you know, victimized as a result of this. State Senator Nate Bolton says he will stay in the Iowa Senate. Back in May, you may remember, State Senator Nate Bolton out of Des Moines, a Democrat, was credibly accused by three different women of sexual misconduct, essentially groping them while he was in a bar with them. He never denied the allegations. He dropped out of the governor's race prior to the Democratic primary, but announced on Monday he will not step down from the Iowa Senate. He blamed his behavior on binge drinking, considering the encounters happened in a bar. You know, that's not surprising to me. Most people, I think, wouldn't act that way without being under the influence of alcohol. Here's his letter I want to read. quote, "I cannot apologize enough for the heartache caused by the stories of those who came forward in May. To those individuals, my supporters, my constituents, and my friends and family, I'm sorry. I commit to making sure that such actions are never raised again about my conduct. I have said that I remember these situations differently, with a differing context, but decline to share more to avoid shaming, blaming, and excuse-making. I absolutely do have differing accounts, but my perspective is likely clouded by intoxication, you think? Moreover, my perspective has less relevance to the experiences of those who felt that I crossed lines. Excessive drinking has no doubt led me to misread appropriate social boundaries and make choices that I would never tolerate while sober." That's an understatement of the year. "In brutal honesty, binge drinking was a problem in my past and has caused hurt and embarrassment, including an OWI in 2011. That's interesting. That just came out. I didn't realize that about his past. I now understand, he writes, more fully the impact of that behavior that behavior has had on others. I have made progress in my drinking behavior since last year, and to show this is something I take quite seriously, for months I have not had a single drink. I made this change because I want to be the man I believe myself to be and the man my supporters believed in. No one has seen me intoxicated, act inappropriately, or ever appear to cross boundaries since November when I made this change in my life. It is my firm intention that something like this will never ever will happen ever again. I did turn to alcohol when rumors swirled and stories were published. When I ended a campaign I poured my heart into, or as my personal character became a topic of humiliating public debate, I hope and believe that passing this test is a good start to a better life." Oh, excuse me. He said, "I did not turn to alcohol when all this was taking place." He continues, "I want to thank everyone who has reached out to me, but especially my wife, Andrea, who has shown grace, resolve, and steadfast support. I believe each of us is stronger than our weakest moments, and that our potential will always be brighter than how it might appear in our darkest hours. I'm committed to proving that. I now strive to make an example of hope for everyone struggling through a personal crisis. I'm motivated to live out that positive example for Iowans, for my family, and for myself. The responsibilities I have to my constituents and as a dedicated advocate for working families across the state have not ended. The next step in my journey comes in January as I return to serve in the Iowa Senate, humbled but determined." So, Minority Leader Janet Peterson, also Democrat from Des Moines, called on Bolton back in May to resign from the Iowa Senate, not just drop out of the race. But at this time, he has not lost any of his committee or caucus assignments. You know, binge drinking is not an excuse. While it's good that he's taking steps to address this problem in his life, and I'm happy he's committed to setting a better example, and I'm happy that he realizes what he did was wrong and that his recollections of the events that took place were probably clouded with alcohol or by the alcohol. He still sexually assaulted women. There has to be a consequence to this, and he should step down from the Iowa Senate. The former Iowa Senate Majority Leader, Bill Dick, stepped down after a consensual extramarital relationship that, as far as we know, only included kissing. I don't want to speculate on what happened beyond that, but he was called out on it. It came known. He resigned, not just from his leadership position, but from the Iowa Senate. And that was consensual. Bolton should do the same. If Senator Peterson is serious about Bolton's status in the Iowa Senate, she must strip him of all responsibility and marginalize him in order to pressure his resignation. Otherwise, her statement, these are just empty words. Next, I speak with Jeremy Davis, who was nominated to run for state treasurer at the Republican Party of Iowa State Convention. He works for the National Pork Producers. He is a former member of the Ames City Council. He also previously ran for the Iowa Senate, and he is currently the treasurer for the Story County Republican Party. But before we get to my conversation with Jeremy, first a word from one of our sponsors, American Principles Project.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
Hey, Jeremy, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me and our listeners. And a question that I always ask every candidate that I talk to, what made you decide to run?
You bet. Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you for inviting me on to speak with everybody and you today. It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's always nice to be able to share some of my thoughts as well. It's obviously been a very quick and busy 3.5 weeks since the state convention. Mm-hmm. And what really led up to the process of running for state treasurer is very interesting. And, you know, truth be told, if you were going to ask me in May, had I been thinking about running, I would have said no. A lot of things transpired very shortly after Memorial Day weekend. Mm-hmm. And one thing led to another. And with the governor reaching out to me and asking if I'd be interested in considering running, and after some careful thought and consideration and prayers and talking with friends and family, I made the decision to do it. So why am I doing this? Well, one of the things that I've really felt over the years, and just watching how the state treasurer's office functions, I have a strong belief that in true fiscal transparency and accountability. Mm-hmm. And I think as a state treasurer, you need to be 100% fiscally transparent to the people of Iowa. And I think that is abundantly important. And I think there's a lot of things that can be implemented at the state level that can really help to show the transparency to the people of Iowa, not just in terms of the actual, you know, checks written and, you know, who they're going to, but how the money really flows from when the state legislature allocates those funds to how they're actually being distributed and allocated within the various departments and agencies of the state. I think that's a very big important factor, because I really don't think Iowans fully understand the way the whole budgeting process works. And that's part of the reason how I came up with the tagline of being the quote unquote taxpayer's advocate, because I think it's very important that, you know, while you have the state auditor who Mary Mosman does a great job with auditing the finances of the state at the state level, the county level, the local municipal level, to ensure there's no fraud or wrongdoing in those allocation of funds and spending of those funds. I think at the state level, there's a disconnect there between the taxpayers a lot of times and how that money is actually being spent. And I think it's important that someone is there that's their advocate, that decisions are being made at the state legislative level, or a proposal by the governor's in the governor's budget, that there's a voice there that says, hey, you know, this is what you're doing. Why are you doing this? You know, what is your rationale and decision? And then going back to the people of Iowa and explaining why those decisions are being made. I think too often legislators and you know, when they do their allocations, don't often give enough explanation to the people of Iowa and help them understand why taxpayer dollars are being spent the way they are.
Okay.
And so I think it's very important that we build a higher level of transparency to show more accountability at the state level for the people of Iowa. The second thing is that I sincerely believe that that part of being state treasurer is a very important function of state government. And part of the reason I say that is because it effectively is the chief revenue officer of the state. It's the entity that monitors the tax collections as they come in from all various sectors of the economy. And here in Iowa, if our manufacturing and our agriculture sectors are strong, businesses are growing, our communities are thriving, our economy is healthy when those two sectors are growing. And I believe it's very important to have a state treasurer that is a not only the chief revenue officer of the state, but is also a champion for economic development. Because when our economy is growing and our economy is strong, we are having revenue that can meet our needs. But then as the advocate for the taxpayer, you're there talking to the state legislature and being and holding the legislature accountable for spending those taxpayer dollars. Because if our economy is growing and we're bringing in tax revenues at a greater level, mm-hmm. why can't we have tax cuts? Why do we need to be taxing our people at the level that we're currently at? What can we do to be more efficient with our taxpayer dollars? Which brings me to the next point, is looking at duplication and redundancy of services within the state. I've been involved in, you know, state politics for several years. I used to work for state government. I've been involved at the local community level as a member of the city council in Ames. And I've seen over the years where there is duplication of services. And I think it's very important that we have a state treasurer that takes an initiative to launch an effort when elected that will look at those redundancies and duplication of services to building a task force that's going to look at those and bring recommendations forward not only to the governor's office, but to the legislature about how we can be more effective and more efficiently utilizing of the taxpayer dollars by eliminating some of those redundancies and duplication of services, which then ultimately will go to benefit the taxpayer. So those are some general points why I'm doing this. I think it's important for Iowa that you have a strong state treasurer that is an advocate for the taxpayers, that's willing to stand up, be their voice in state government, and point out where things need to be changed, but also be the person that is the advocate for the economy and helping build the economy and be a strong proponent of economic development. Because like I said, when our ag and our manufacturing sectors are strong, our state is strong. And that's a key important factor that I think our current state treasurer is lacking. And I think it's important that we have a state treasurer that is a proponent of those aspects. And I think if we do it right, not only can we build the economy, we can also have a stronger state at the end of the day.
Okay. Give our listeners more of an idea of your background. You already mentioned some of that in the first answer here, but how were you qualified? Tell us a little bit about yourself and your qualifications.
Absolutely. So I grew up on a farm in eastern Iowa. I'm in rural Jones County, and I grew up there. My parents are still farmers yet. Grew up on a traditional, you know, livestock and grain farm in Iowa. Nothing too out of the ordinary. Corn, soybeans, cattle. And after growing up there on the farm, went to school at Iowa State University, where I earned a bachelor's and master's in ag education, as well as a master's in higher ed. And then following my collegiate experience, I worked at Iowa State for a little bit, and then got into working with the state of Iowa, doing legislative affairs, and then ultimately worked for Congressman Steve King for a couple of years in the district. And now the last several years, I've been working for the National Pork Producers Council as their director of grassroots. And so through my career and professional wise, I've really built up an understanding of the philosophies of government, and I've been exposed to different levels of government, like I said, at the local, the county, the state, and the federal levels. And I've really identified areas that I believe we as a country can be doing better, you know, and as a state, we can be doing better. And I think a lot of that is just through life experience, you know, as you're involved in, you know, whether it's serving on the city council like I did in Ames for several years, where you're looking at the financial operations of the state and trying to be an advocate for the taxpayers there to ensure that, you know, the taxpayers are getting the best and efficient use of their taxpayer dollars, you really get an appreciation for when you're making decisions mm-hmm. that you know you're not spending your own money. You're making decisions that are spending other people's money. And once you get that appreciation and understanding why that is so important, to have that understanding and appreciation for the responsibility that the voters have given you to be their watchdog, you know, to be their advocate, to ensure that the taxpayer dollars are being spent correctly and appropriately. It's a huge responsibility. And through those experiences and through my professional career, I've really developed an understanding about why it's important to be that advocate for the taxpayers, to make sure things are being done right at the state level, to make sure taxpayer dollars are being spent correctly. And so from a educational perspective, you know, it's what part of the education of, you know, growing up in ag education. You know, I grew up, like I said, on a farm, and I was heavily involved with the FFA programs. I ultimately served as a state vice president here in Iowa. And through those experiences, it started building my leadership profile. Mm-hmm. And getting a lot of leadership experiences. And through that, you start building a network and you start learning how to understand and critically analyze things you see. And when you see those things and you look at them, you say, you know, that's not right. You know, what can we do to make that better? And in those type of experiences, as you start looking at those and you collectively build those over the course of, you know, 20 years of life experience, mm-hmm. when you get into a position like this where you're running for the state treasurer's position, you can sit there and say, yes, I pay taxes, you pay taxes, we're all paying taxes, but you as Iowans, we all need someone to be an advocate,
right?
As a state treasurer. And I think that's what I bring forward, is that, you know, I've got life experience growing up on a farm. You know, obviously I grew up in the 80s when the farm crisis was there. I saw how my parents struggled through the farm crisis, and knowing, mm-hmm. you know, you just never knew how things were going to go until the end of the year when harvest came along, because interest rates were high, the credit opportunities were not great, you know, just the general farm crisis as well. And so there was a lot of challenges. And so when you grow up in an environment like that and understanding the challenges that the people of Iowa are facing, and whether it was growing up in the farm crisis of the 80s or the challenges going on in today's ag sector with some of the tariffs going on, the tariff concerns, mm-hmm. the people of Iowa need a strong advocate in the state treasurer's office, because if there's not an advocate there for them, and when you've got these concerns going on, whether it's in the tariffs that are affecting the ag industry, the manufacturing sectors, that's a problem. You need to have an advocate there that's going to be the champion for the people of Iowa, and that's really the type of experiences I think I can bring to this.
Okay. Quick question regarding your experience. You'd mentioned earlier that you were a member of the Ames City Council. How long did you serve, and what lessons did you pull from that? Because I can't imagine it was probably easy being a Republican on the Ames City Council. Or I know it's probably not, but I think you were probably one of what, maybe two Republicans on the council.
I would say pretty much.
Okay.
You bet. No, I was elected in 2009, and then concluded my term at the end of 2013. So I did a 4-year term on the city council. And when I ran for city council, one of my priorities was to be a strong pro-growth candidate. And the reason for that was, obviously in 2008, 2009, our state was going through the Great Recession just like everyone else was. Mm-hmm. And in Ames, unemployment was starting to tick up. Unemployment was increasing. And we had a city council at that time leading up to 2009, that was not a pro-growth council. It was, for all intents and purposes, growth had ground to a halt in Ames. And when I made the decision to run, I did so because I felt I could bring something to the city that could be a strong pro-growth message that would let people know that if I was elected, I was going to do everything I could to make sure Ames was open for business. And so I, along with my fellow council members that also got elected that year, there was actually 3 new members of the council elected in that fall. Mm-hmm. And we joined a gentleman who had been on the council for a couple of years prior to that, who was also a very pro-growth individual. And in the course of those first couple of years, we turned the culture of the city. And we worked diligently to reduce the red tape and the burdens that developers were having to work through at the city level. We became, like I said, a very pro-growth city council that was very oriented. We looked at development where we could bring, you know, help encourage new businesses and existing businesses to expand, and not only expand physically, but also increase their employment counts. And through that, obviously over the course of 4 years, the economy of Ames grew. And because the economy of Ames grew, that ultimately resulted in higher levels of sales taxes coming in, higher levels of hotel motel taxes coming in. Mm-hmm. And then as a result of that, you also have property valuations to take into account for. And one thing we were able to do while I was on the council is reduce the overall millage rate throughout the 4 years while I was on council. And we were able to do that because sales taxes were increasing. We were able to reallocate a number of those funds and to help offset the property taxes. And so as a result of that, plus using hotel motel taxes for some community betterment programs, we were able to actually help the taxpayer names. And when you can help the taxpayer by reducing the millage rate, giving more opportunities for the community, and being a pro-growth, strongly focused on economic development, growing the economy, helping implement policies that encourage businesses to expand and reinvest and bring new exciting opportunities to the community, that's a really great thing to see when you can actually see it physically happening. And so through those efforts and being sort of the fiscal watchdog, which is what I really focused on while I was on the council, those type of experiences helped me see the bigger picture and helped me understand that, hey, you know, these are truly taxpayer dollars of the people of our community. I'm going to make every decision I do in the best interest of the citizens of Ames, because I want to make sure that any decision I make, we are spending their taxpayer dollars appropriately, wisely, and responsibly. And so through that, I've taken that responsibility factor all the way through through my career, the last several years, and now in running for state treasurer. I believe those same type of principles that I utilize as a city council can be applied at the state treasurer's office and applied on a larger scale throughout the state, and really help grow our state by implementing policy, by helping implement policies that grow our economy, grow our state, do the right things, and be transparent to the citizens of Iowa at the same time.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about, you know, you're talking about you want to bring transparency to the office. You want to be an advocate for the taxpayer. Specifically, if elected, what would you do differently to bring transparency to the state treasurer's office that Michael Fitzgerald currently is not doing?
Sure. And thanks for the question on that. As you know, this past legislative cycle, our end session, the state legislature passed a piece of legislation that prohibited the use of taxpayer dollars for self-promotion for statewide elected candidates and officials.
I missed that. I didn't realize they passed that.
Yes, they did. Yep.
Excellent.
And it became effective on July 1st. And for several years, I've had a concern with the way the current state treasurer utilizes funds, public funds, for self-promotion. And one of those aspects that's been used is that for promoting this 529 plan. And I've been concerned about the way the commercials have been rolled out on TV for the 529 plan that effectively have self-promoted the state treasurer. And so when I was nominated at the state convention, I pointed that out, that I had concerns that public funds were being utilized for the promotion of the office and the individual in that current office there. Following the state convention, OK Henderson with Radio Iowa reached out to the state treasurer's office and asked for a comment on that. And the spokesperson for Michael Fitzgerald responded with that the 529 is a self-sustaining program and that no taxpayer dollars are being utilized for the promotion of it. So in my mind, and I thought about this, and I looked at the statement that was said, so you look at it and you're saying, well, if the 529 program is a self-sustaining program and no taxpayers are being utilized to promote it, then what's happening is that the promotion is coming from the utilization of the investment earnings from the 529 plan.
Right.
And to me, those investment earnings should be going back to the people of Iowa and their families to help pay for higher education.
Right.
Not for self-promotion on TV ads. And I think that's one of the things that when I'm elected state treasurer, even if the program is self-sustaining, I pledge to not promote myself as state treasurer to help encourage the people of Iowa to utilize the 529 plan.
So if there was any kind of PR campaign for the 529 plans, it would be, you wouldn't see Jeremy
solely
Davis,
it would be
state
solely
treasurer.
The 529 plan.
Yeah, your name would be
plastered.
Okay.
Right. Yep. It would be Iowa's 529 plan, not Michael Fitzgerald's 529 plan or Jeremy Davis's 529 plan. It would be Iowa's 529 plan. I would make sure that my name was not being utilized to promote that plan, because I believe that is a program that truly is self-sustaining, and it is for the people of Iowa. It is not to be utilized to self-promote any statewide official.
Okay. I know one thing, the Iowa Department of Management has done quite a bit to try to bring more transparency to the state of Iowa. They have a public checkbook. They have different data sets that are accessible. How do you think that could be improved upon?
Well, I think anything you can do in today's day and age when it comes to transparency, we can improve upon. I think, you know, when you look at where we're at in terms of technology, you know, we're in the state where we have, you know, obviously investments from Google and Microsoft and Facebook, and we have, you know, cloud computing at its finest. And I think, you know, while it's great that the data sets are available, the checkbook's available online, I think we need to make it more user-friendly for people to be able to not only see where, you know, you look at where the budget itself is presented at, but then go into those budget lines through, you know, searching and see just how the funds are being allocated through those budget lines and are being spent, you know. So, for example, if someone goes online to see that, you know, a particular check was sent to a particular vendor from a state agency, the people of Iowa can then say that where those funds actually came from within the budget line items themselves and understand how the funds actually flow from what the state legislature does, the governor's office approves the budget or line items accordingly, and then they can see exactly how the funds actually flow. Because I think that's one thing that's really missing right now is that people can look at the data sets, they can look at the checkbook, but you can't really get that integrated approach so you can truly see how the funds flow from step A to step Z.
Okay. Are there any other ideas that you have that you'd like to, like, you know, I would implement, like, right away when coming into office?
You know, I think one of the first things that, and I spoke about this at a few different events I've been at, is that immediately following my election and getting sworn in following January 1st, one of the first things I want to do is launch the task force that is going to review where there and determine where the duplication and redundancy of services are occurring at throughout state government. I think that's a very important thing that needs to occur because obviously things have changed a lot since 1982 when state treasurer was elected, and state government has grown. We know that. And I think with state government's grown at the rate it has, and whether it's the direct state government or we're talking about the regent universities or wherever it might be at in different auxiliary aspects of the state, I think it's important for the state treasurer to have a pulse on the whole financial transactions of the entire state government. And to do that, you need to understand where there's those redundancies and duplication of services are at. You know, for example, is there a need to have three standalone independent accounting systems for the regent universities? You know, why does the Board of Regents have three individual standalone accounting systems rather than one accounting system for the Board of Regents? You know, and we're talking systems, you know, the actual technology behind it. Why are there three independent accounting systems? And what is the interface they have to the state? You know, those are questions that need to be asked, because if there's three independent accounting systems right now, what if we looked at consolidating them into one accounting platform for all three regent universities? What kind of cost savings could that be for the state of Iowa? You know, over the past legislative cycle, people were very concerned that the state legislature had to cut funding that would go to the regent universities. Well, what if we look at where some of those redundancies and duplication services are at, even within the three regent universities, and could bring some of the costs down to operate the university system? There's cost savings that we can find, and we can help and work with the Board of Regents to implement those. That's part of what I think is really important that the state treasurer needs to be doing. You need to be reaching out to those departments throughout state government, whether it's the departments, agencies, the Board of Regents, the universities, finding out where those duplication services are at and helping implement solutions that eliminate those redundancies where appropriate and help bring down the overall cost of running state government. And I think that's one of the first things that needs to happen when I'm elected.
Okay, just one last question. First of all, it's two-part. Is there anything that I haven't asked that you'd like to talk about regarding your race and your platform? And where can people learn more?
Sure, you bet. Well, first of all, like I said, I appreciate the opportunity to join you on your podcast today. I think it's a great opportunity to share my message, my thoughts, and where I want to take the position going forward when elected. So I do appreciate the opportunity to do this.
You are very welcome.
In terms of where the folks, You bet. I appreciate that again. So in terms of where people can learn more about me, you can visit my website at jeremyndavis.com, or you can visit our Facebook page as well, which is Facebook/Davis for State Treasurer. There's some more information about each one of my priorities and different platform perspectives that I think are important for Iowans to know more about me and know where I stand on those issues. Of course, people can always send me an email and or give me a call and chat about those issues as well. Happy to discuss any of those topics with any Iowan. I think it's important that everyone has the opportunity to talk to me and share their thoughts with me as well. So from that perspective, I want to always have the quote-unquote open door policy, because I think it's important that as a state treasurer that, you know, is the chief revenue officer of the state, I think people need to be accessible. And I think as the treasurer, you need to be accessible to the people. And so I want to have an open door communication policy that people can ask me questions, you know, what my thoughts are on the various issues, because I think that's important for people to know and understand where their taxpayer dollars are going and what my thoughts for the office are as well. So, that happy to talk to any Iowan. I think it's important that we look at the state treasurer's office. I think it's a very important office within the state government. I think it's sometimes because it's one of the down ballot offices, I think people sometimes overlook it a little bit.
Right.
But the other component that's very important about the state treasurer is what really happens when the state legislature is not in session, and that's part of being called as part of the state executive council. And for folks that don't know what the state executive council is, it's basically the governing council of the state that operates and functions when the state legislature is not in session. That's when they make a lot of their decisions. And it's all the statewide elected positions from the governor down through the secretary of ag, state treasurer, state auditor, attorney general, and so on. And so this position is not just about being the chief revenue officer. It's about being part of the state executive council as well, that's helping make decisions that are the right, that are common sense, logic-based, data-driven decisions that need to be made throughout the course of the year when the legislature's not in session, because it's an important function. And I think that sometimes often overlooked, that folks don't always understand that being the state treasurer is not just state treasurer. It's also a seat at the executive council. And then it's also, you know, part of the board that oversees programs such as IPERS and the police officer's retirement and accident and disability system. Those are very important aspects of the role. And when we bring more transparency to the office and be more transparent and help Iowans see more data and understand where their finances are at, when we're looking at programs like IPERS and the police officer's retirement program, I think the more we can be transparent with Iowans about those programs so they understand that, you know, when and if deficiencies in funding are occurring, or, you know, what the long-term projections are, we want to be as transparent as possible so that way we're not surprising Iowans, you know, in 5 years saying, you know, we've reached a cliff that we've got to address right now. We want to be as transparent as we can so that way people can fully understand where their finances are at, mm-hmm. because it's no different than you or I when we're sitting at home. We're looking at our checkbook, we're looking at our savings account, and we're looking at it and saying, okay, this is my budget for this year. This is my budget for this month. This is how I can make things work for the next, you know, month or 12 months. It's no different than at the state level, just right. On a much bigger perspective.
You bring it
and
up.
When we're talking about programs. What's that?
You bringing up IPERS just brought to mind another question. What's your view of our pension system right now? I mean, do you think it's healthy? Do we need to be concerned?
I think at any time we're looking at a pension program, I think there needs to be a general level of concern tied to those type of programs, because at any given time, depending on what the markets do because of the investment structure that's tied to each one of these programs, if we hit a significant recession or a significant economic downturn, there are potential issues that can affect those investment funds. So I think the more we can be cognizant and very transparent about those programs and show a general level of concern at any given time, I think that's important for people to understand. And so do I think IPERS is generally healthy right now? Fundamentally speaking, it is okay. It's not as healthy as it should be. But it's not on dire straits either.
Not like
Illinois. Now, that said, what's that?
It's not like Illinois.
Right. Oh, definitely not. We are definitely not in that situation. But I do think that it will be important for example, the IPRS board and the Police Officers Retirement Advisory Commission to look at where the fund is currently at and look at what long-term implications are for how the policies are built right now. And do we need to make fundamental changes in the investment strategy or how the allocations are returned to the folks that have invested into those programs, which are our public employees? Because when those folks started their employment, whether it was 35, 40 years ago, or even 5 years ago, the state made a promise to every one of those people. And we have to make sure we fulfill that promise because it's important to do. But to do that, we as the, you know, the governing board that oversees IPRS or the other pension funds, those folks need to be cognizant of that fact and make decisions that are in the best interest of Iowans to ensure that promise is maintained to the best ability. And to do that, it is not an easy task, and there's a lot of responsibility tied to those programs. And that's why it's important that when we're talking about IPRS and, you know, programs like the Police Officers Retirement Program, people need to know that there is a general level of concern there, because there's so many different external factors that can affect the overall funding of those programs, such as if, like I said, if there's a downturn in the economy, you know, what does the state legislature need to do if there's a downturn in the economy to ensure that the people of Iowa are maintaining that promise
right.
that they have if they've worked for the state? There's so many different factors that can affect these types of pension programs that we cannot just sail off into the wind and say it's going to be great long term. We have a vigilant and watchful eye on these programs to ensure that promise is maintained to the people that invest into this program from the time they started working for the public sector to the time they retired, and then on past their retirement as they're receiving the benefits that they've earned through working for the state or in the public entity they work for.
Okay. Well, hey, thank you so much for your time. I want to respect your time. I know you got another phone call to jump on like right now. So I will talk to you later, and best of luck to you.
Hey, thank you very much for the opportunity to chat with you this afternoon.
You're very welcome. Take care.
You too. Bye.
That concludes today's episode of the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, please make sure you go check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. That's CAFFEINATED thoughts.com. Or just Google Caffeinated Thoughts and we'll show up at the top of your search screen. Also, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and sign up for our email so that you don't miss a single article. Also, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Be sure, please, to give us 5 stars. We would appreciate it. You can also listen on Google Play, Podbean, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. If you're not a subscriber, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode, and you can listen using your favorite podcast app. Until next time, my friends, this is Shane Vanderhart. Take care.